Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of the fun things about doing a podcast is that I can reach out to really interesting authors, writers, artists, musicians, and who, if they're generous or maybe if they're not too famous yet, they're happy to talk to a small but vital podcaster like me. And so I get to sort of extend my circle of contacts and intellectual partners. But another fun thing that it does, particularly as someone who is not on Facebook, is that it allows me to reconnect with people in my personal life who have been important interlocutors and really just kind of have a conversation, figure out where they're at. Because sometimes, you know, you haven't seen people for a while, you don't keep up with people too much, and you just sort of chit-chat, how you doing, this and that. But it's sometimes harder, unless you have more time, to really get down and figure out where people are coming from, especially people who have been important in your own evolution. And one of those folks is our guest today, Ronan Halliwell, who I first met in the mid-90s in San Francisco. I moved out here from New York in 1995, and it had been an exciting period, the early 90s in New York City, and it was still an exciting period out here in San Francisco, just as all the sort of first internet bubble was in the air. But before that was really a kind of remarkable period of cultural efflorescence of sort of classic California tribal utopianism mixed with technology and even some pretty good critical thinking about the possibilities of new technologies as a kind of transformative culture. But I'd go to these parties, and most of them they were fun parties and electronic dance music and dancing and funny clothes and all that. It wasn't often that I would encounter people that I could have a real conversation with, a real deep conversation, that is. And but Ronan was one of these, and he was a DJ, was a character on the scene, really interested in transformative culture, but like many intellectuals, also possessed a kind of critical and not always a rosy frame of mind, which I have to say I can very much appreciate and share in many ways. So we hit it off and had a lot of great conversations and have kept in touch over the years, and I decided to talk to him. As I said, he was very interested in transformative culture and the emerging dance scenes. Had developed very long-term and fully embodied, authentic relations with some Native American traditions, particularly the Lakota surrounding their sun dance, and we'll talk about that some in a little bit. And but for the last 15 years, he's been teaching high school at New Roads, which is I think a fancy school in Santa Monica, teaching World Civ and media and other related ideas. And so I just want to check in with Ronan, see how he's doing. So Ronan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Great, nice to be here and renew our discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, give me a little more about who you were when I first met you, in the sense of what was engaging you about the sort of transformative culture of that period in its mixture of media and dance and new forms of thought and emerging technology. What was sort of shaping you at that time in ways that would really lead to your later course through life?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was trying to think back of how we originally met, and some of that early time was San Francisco, but I was saying we actually met in May of 1990.
Oh, that's right.
Third International Conference on Cyberspace.
That's it. I have a crap memory for that stuff.
I was reviewing back, and most of our time was hanging out in San Francisco, but I had just graduated from Boston College, undergrad, with a degree in the dismal science, as it's called, economics, but I had gotten at Boston College, gotten into underground radio at Boston WZBC Boston College Radio, which is where I got into DJing and the underground dance music culture. But there was a sort of underground scene there, and through that Boston culture, I got interested in the internet. I had my first email through Boston College Radio on one of those digital VAX mini mainframe computers, and somehow ended up at this conference out at University of Texas. And, you know, it was a really rich and interesting mix of people. And you were one of them.
Yeah. And Mark Pesci.
Mark Pesci and people like Catherine Hales and Sandy.
Was Rushkoff there?
I'm not sure. I don't recall that off the top of my head, but it was those types of folks. A guy named Mark Taylor, who was a theologian. It's, I think, at Columbia now.
Yeah. Big name.
Yeah. It was quite an interesting cast of characters. And when we still use that term, cyberspace was, there was a lot of, you know, there were architects and computer scientists and music people and all these various sorts. So I was young and excitable back in those days. And then I'd also gotten into this dance music culture. And then ended up in San Francisco around the same time that you moved up there in 1994. And a major thing I learned through my economics degree was this, what a mess the system really is. And I was sort of being taught by the high priests of that. A lot of my professors were from MIT or places like that, you know, quite traditional. And although it was interesting to kind of learn the nuts and bolts, I came away from it being inspired by other more liberal professors at BC to really kind of see the cracks in this system, and yet really, you know, realizing that it is what it is. You have to work with it and deal with it. But I was looking for, you know, some deeper meaning and where might that come from? Cause I certainly wasn't seeing it in economics.
In a way it was like your experience of that, of the kind of, you know, being a DJ and being in that scene wasn't just for kicks, but it wasn't even just for the sense of community that it could create. Or the sense of a deeper meaning or a sense of sort of tribal experience, but that you could see in that a little bit of a possibility for a different way of organizing things.
Yeah, definitely. You know, at that time, I was introduced to that Hakeem Bey book, The Temporary Autonomous Zone, by some friends at the radio station, and part of the programming at WZBC that's somewhat reasonably well known for, at least in Boston, is called No Commercial Potential. This is real avant-garde music, but within that, because of the intellectual scene it was in, you know, there was this kind of thinking part that went with the music exploration, and at this time, the Temporary Autonomous Zone is, you know, trying to find little experimental places of humanity and immanence, transcendence, combinations. And that was quite influential, as well as just being part of the radio station. I met a lot of people from other schools and saw Noam Chomsky lecture and people like that, and interviewed people like Michael Franti from Spearhead, and, you know, kind of seeing where... Yeah, and following, there was definitely a remnant from the 60s in a lot of this, but was definitely coming into a new kind of 90s rave underground type stuff, but with even more the advanced technology, with the internet really taking off and virtual reality being a big thing of kind of like exploring these other worlds, which, you know, kind of flamed out a little bit.
Well, it was funny because the whole thing around virtual reality, kind of like cyberspace, both of those concepts were as important as sort of conceptual figures or fantasies as they were in reality. I mean, if you looked at what was actually happening with virtual reality, yes, there was a data glove. Yes, there was VPL. Yes, there were these things. But much more so were people getting off on the possibilities. And so there was kind of this weird half real, half virtual kind of event that was sort of swallowing everyone up. And it's, you know, really only now that we're really looking at virtual reality in the way that, you know, people were fantasizing about then. And still we're not even, you know, that far along. So it was a very strange time in terms of like what was actually real on the ground and what was sort of a strange, vision that was sort of swallowing people up. But I guess that's true of a lot of periods of cultural, efflorescence. I mean, the 60s was like that in some ways as well. But it's interesting for you that while that was a very fulfilling thing, you are also drawn to make a connection with indigenous practices of ritual and community celebration. And you really kind of, you know, went out on a limb in a way, going out to, Lakota land and joining up with, helping out at the Sundances and not doing it for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, but really making it a part of your life, including because you're a self-aware intellectual and political thinker, becoming very aware of at every stage of the challenges and the difficulties of appropriation, et cetera, et cetera. Why did you hear that call and why did you keep pursuing it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I tell my students this oftentimes because I sing for them, and I teach them about these traditions. I say, you know, until I was in my 20s, I had never met a Native American person through all my education, even at Boston College. It really just was not, I didn't learn much about it besides sort of stereotyped Western movies. I'd never met even a person that I would say, oh, that's a Native American person and they're part of this tribal nation. But as I was sort of emerging out of undergrad and sort of on this, you know, quest for wisdom and that looking at the world's wisdom traditions and religions and, okay, where is it located? And you start looking, okay, the roots of religion are in shamanic indigenous traditions. So kind of a rational thought process took me first at, okay, this is sort of what I'm interested in learning about. Here are the roots of it. And, you know, synchronistically enough, it was somebody through the underground dance music scene that he's about 20 years older than me, had been around in the 60s and a lot of the early environmental movement. He lived out in Marin County, and he invited me to a sweat lodge. And I had, you know, started to read because I was in the master's program at the California Institute of Integral Studies. So getting just the first experience of doing the sweat lodge, it was really just eye-opening. It was, for me, someone with such a heavy mental bent, just to really have an embodied experience. And it was just very visceral and, it was challenging, but it was also felt like home in certain ways. And, you know, I just sort of followed that shortly after that, sweat with an elder chief from the Arapaho Nation. He must have been 75 or 80, and he died shortly after. And there was just something to it, not to overly romanticize. Native people have struggled through so much, but there really was just this deep, powerful connection to the land and this kind of continuity. And also, when we could put on hold for a minute the racial issues and the oppression, there was just an intense and very beautiful humanity that resonated with me. And I felt like it was really a great balance toward my intellectual side and then thinking about, well, I care about ecological issues. I'm not really sure what to do with it. I'm interested in social justice. I live here in the United States. So it's sort of, all right, this makes sense. I need to kind of learn about where I'm at and who are these people that were here before. And it just really kind of went from there. And
one of the things I've liked about your story, and I know you've written about this as well, is the way in which you, without you know, without ignoring the tremendous issues around appropriation and around the, you know, horrible tragedy, unimaginable tragedy of the Native American experience over the last 200, 300, 400 years in the United States, being fully mindful of that, you were still able to allow yourself and to make real connections with real people, or, you know, and to resonate and to open up into that other zone, whether or not there was some romance in the picture. You know, there's always some romance somewhere along the way in the thing, you know, in our attraction to everything, you know, anything that attracts us, there's some kind of romance. You can't avoid that unless you're just going to sit on your haunches and never do anything and say, oh, I'm not even going to talk to a Native American person because I don't want to romanticize them or project on them or to appropriate what they say or anything, which, you know, you can see that in some kind of zones of the left where they're just almost like a refusal to live in the face of the enormity, which is a genuine enormity. But one of the things that really strikes me is, and I'll ask you to sort of tell the tale and then maybe make a comment about it, is just when you first went out to a Sundance and you did your sweat and you had to, you know, hear that an elder stand up and, you know, it was kind of a trial by fire in terms of these political issues. I think, you know, can you talk about that when you first went out?
Yeah, it was. I'd been to a couple dances before, but this was the first time on the reservation, Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. And, you know, I'd sort of driven out there by myself. I was working on my master's thesis and, you know, just ended up in a sweat lodge on the reservation with, you know, with people of all Native affiliation. I mean, they were mixed, of mixed blood and whatnot. But, you know, the lodge is similar to ones I'd been in, and oftentimes there's a space for people to express themselves, or you might go around the circle. And, you know, it came to me, and I expressed my gratitude, and then kind of came around to this older gentleman. And, you know, he really, you know, he didn't specifically address me, but it really sounded like it, and really just kind of went through a litany of, you know, these white people that have done all these things and now they come to our ceremonies, sort of like we're just kind of getting things going again, and you guys, you can't leave us alone, and now you want, you know, to come here and take the last bit that we have. And it was real hard to listen to, but it was also a place to be able to sit with, you know, being uncomfortable, and then also coming to yourself and saying, you know, that isn't what I'm doing. And I have asked for guidance from real elders and native elders and other people. And so you have to learn how to sit in your own truth and know that in your heart, you're trying to deal with these things. And at the end of the day, we are all just people beyond all these other things. And I think, you know, all people have to find that place, and you know, sometimes being pushed beyond our comfort zone is quite a enriching arena, and a lot of the Sundance is about being uncomfortable. Oftentimes for people performing the dance, it has a lot to do with pain and going beyond it, and also learning to make sacrifices, doing things and learning things that don't just benefit ourselves but benefit the community. And through that great challenge, there is also a lot of personal gratification that can come from that. And I think that's something that our mainstream culture doesn't understand very well.
Yeah. And I mean, just to draw out the connection, and I think it's a really, really, really profound one. I mean, particularly, I mean, always the case, but especially given over the last 2 years, how the dialogue around race and reparations and stuff has come so strongly again in the States, particularly around black people and you know, but really across the board there's just more awareness about it. Is there something really beautiful about that moment where whatever the motivation of the speaker and whatever their identity and whatever you can say about it, at some level you just take it, and you don't take it in like a liberal guilt kind of way, like you're like, oh, we're so bad, I'm gonna do everything I can. No, it's just because you still have to be strong in your own place, but on another level you just hear it. You just Absolutely. Hear it, and you don't try to say anything. You don't try to justify where you're coming from, and the strength to be able to do that and to then hold it, like hold your poison, hold the poison, which isn't yours or theirs, or it's both of yours or whatever. It's eternal, you know, it's the eternal, you know, river of poison that animates human existence. There's something really powerful about that, and it's just so easily lost in the kind of back and forth and what's your position and you're using the right language and, oh, we gotcha, and all this sort of horribly degraded forms of dialogue that are surrounding these things now. It's really it's like a double tragedy, because there's the tragedy itself is sort of in our face, and then there's this double tragedy in, you know, how poorly it's dealt with both on both sides or all sides or whatever, just because people are thinking in terms of sides as opposed to, I'm a human being here for my own reasons, and this person has something to say, and I'm just going to listen to it, you know. And I'm
and it was much more powerful than what I had read in the books, you know. And I was aware of that perspective, and I'd even experienced or felt versions of it previous to that, but never quite so intense. But it definitely drove the point home, and it. A deeper opening of compassion of just like how much human damage these things actually do, and beyond, you know, not my personal fault of any of these things, but a responsibility to sit, like you said, sit with it. And to it was good to have read something in the book. It was good to have had previous experience with other people that kind of helped prep me for that. I'd been to about two or three Sundances before that one, and a bunch of sweats, and had engaged with that. But, you know, hearing it on that level, it drove home the point of this deep pain. And again, to sit with it. And I think that's what the ceremony is so profound, and something, you know, that, the Lakota, at least in this, I, you know, don't know all different tribes, ceremonies, and obviously, but at least in this ceremony, it's a profound way for people of different perspectives to sit together and go through something together, and it opens up a space for that. And this kind of it's a different, it's not so discursive. You know, people express themselves, but it's, you know, it wasn't a debate back and forth, or it wasn't me to respond to what he had to say.
It
keeps going.
Yeah, that's a very interesting place. I often think about that. You know, if we let's just take it that we have, there's a verbal part of our consciousness and there's a nonverbal part of our consciousness. Let's be simplistic about it. And but there's a trick, especially if you're a heady person or somebody who's often caught up in discourse and language and argument and da-da-da-da, is that sometimes people are talking to you. Or they're talking, not just to you, but they're just talking. But they're not. It's not really about what they're saying. It's really about what's happening on a nonverbal level, and that's true for you too. But yep. There's, I think, so often, like especially, there's so many words in our society. You know, so much text. Even though we're supposed to be in this kind of video age, there's so much. You know, even the, you know, anytime you're watching a moving image, somebody's talking all the time. There's so much talk. That it gets hard to be able to tune into what's often really more important that's going on. In fact, you can't ever really exactly know what it is because it's not talk. You can't totally ground it. But if you're not willing to make that leap and to try to tune in as well as decode, you know, you're not gonna get very far. You're not gonna grow very much, or be able to handle the kind of political complications that are required when you do the kind of, you know, work you did. The question I have is that, so you were working on your master's, you went out, you were exploring, you were learning something new, but you kept going back for a long time. How did it end up becoming sort of part of who you were, as opposed to what you were studying or what you were exploring?
Yeah, well, the year after I finished the thesis in 1997, and, you know, I was part of a community that I went to every week in the Bay Area that was connected. A lot of these Sundance circles have, it's kind of, you know, they have a lot of interconnections with each other. So this group here has a connection to this group over here. So, you know, I had a real group of people that I spent time with every week. And it was actually the thing that was most profound for me was learning how to sing in Lakota. And so my teacher was in the Bay Area, a Lakota man. His first language, and he'd grown up with the Medicine Man in the 50s and 60s and was a singer for him. So it was an incredible opportunity to learn directly in the oral tradition. I mean, I learned from other folks as well, but he was my primary teacher. And so, you know, I felt part of that community. They helped me through a lot of things beyond just my academics. You know, they took me at really, you know, we were like a small extended family. And so I just, it felt compelling to stay part of that. And then the next year it was hard doing the academic study because I was always kind of questioning myself and my method and disclosure and what was appropriate for academic work and what was appropriate for being a part of the community. And there were people that questioned it. So when I was done, I was like, I want to learn more about it. And so I did go on a vision quest ceremony the summer after I finished my thesis. And that was a really challenging. It was 3 days and three nights with no food or water. Some people do that for four up at a mountain in southern Oregon. And it was really, you know, kind of testing myself. All right, I didn't just do this to get this piece of paper, but I'm really, you know, part of communities of people. And, you know, I was sincere about it. And so I did really say from doing that, it just stuck. And I'm still part of it. There's occasionally a year where I won't be able to make it to the Sundance, or I don't sweat quite as much as I did, but I'm still part of it. And these are people that are still an important part of my life. I just did an event a year ago. I was working on a NASA Earth Science Education grant, and the elder of mine in Oregon, who's 80-year-old, Pima Akamel Odom from Arizona originally, but lives in Oregon. He came and did the whole program with a group of students from a federal Indian boarding school in Oregon, which is a quirky thing that there are some of those that actually still exist. So, yeah, I've been able to continue this in other areas of being an educator. And it's, you know, it's something that's it's not my whole identity, and I'm not, you know, ready to move to the reservation or anything, but it's a profound part of my life. And it's also was really what helped me get into teaching and some of the basic things about relating to young people and becoming a teacher of more than just facts and figures. I've really learned by watching elders and other teachers in that mode, and it's had a real impact on how I ended up becoming a teacher.
Yeah, well, talk more about that. I mean, what I mean that's probably what interests me is you know, I had my high school experience, but that's about all I really think about high school. And I'm really curious how you brought in, you know, you have these additional inspirations as well as a acute mind. And there you are, you're teaching world civilization, you're teaching media ecology, you're working with, you know, young people. How did that, you know, impact your education, your approach to education, your pedagogy?
Yeah, well, you know, coming out of my master's degree, I really kind of would have liked to have continued on for a PhD in higher education, but just family said my parents were ill, and just a variety of different things. And I also thought, I was just after doing the Sundance study, I was really quite spent. It was very emotionally draining. And anyway, just circumstances didn't flow that way.
Life happened
basically, which is, you know, oftentimes what wasn't my master plan, but that, you know, seems to have just isn't the way things work. So I, you know, it was a question people asked me while I was, what are you going to do with a master's degree in philosophy and religion from a quirky school in San Francisco? And, you know, that was a reasonable question. At first, I worked a little bit in the internet industry. I worked at a graduate school with this theologian and priest, Matthew Fox. When he had actually introduced me to the Sundance leader, that I ended up doing the study with, which was I was already into the native stuff, but he introduced me to this medicine man, and at the time I was DJing this event with him, but you know that just wasn't a sustainable. It was interesting work, but wasn't a fiscally responsible pathway. And, you know, the internet stuff was just going crazy. And I was like, all right, let me just try to get some income here. But it really just turned out not to be my cup of tea. And, you know, kind of having spent the last few years pondering philosophy and cosmology and Native American studies, I wasn't quite positioned, you know, right in that industry. And I also just thought it wasn't really me. And so kind of that didn't really pan out. And, you know, it was like, all right, what can I wasn't quite ready to jump back into higher education, you know, to get a doctorate. I was still kind of unclear of how to possibly go about that, or wasn't seeming that viable for various reasons. And it just sort of came, it's like, this is what needs to happen. Some things happened in my life, and I ended up in Hawaii. My brother set up a situation where I was able to live in Kauai. I just made the decision, all right, this is, I'm going to, you know, go into high school teaching, and just some doors opened living over there, and lived there for a few years teaching, and then moved back to Los Angeles to take care of my dad before he passed away, and then ended up at this interesting progressive school called New Roads, which has been a great home. It's like any institution has some things that you know could work on, but it has been a great, really, you know, amazing students and a space to be able to explore these things and use my education. I've been able to develop my curriculum and, you know, been able to sing with my students and have dance experiences with them, but within an intellectual context, and the school's committed to longer term social justice and ecological concerns. And, you know, it just has kind of been, you know, an interesting place. And teenagers, you know, they can be challenging, but they also, there's a freshness, and there is sort of like a seeds that are planted at that time that, you know, can really have a long-term impact.
What do you think, when you think about that idea of the seeds, and what is it, what's the main thing that you would love to plant? You know, what is it that when it's working, you know, you've done well, it's because of these particular either ideas, ways of being in the world, issues to pay attention to, whatever, on whatever level you're thinking about, what are really the core seeds that you want to plant?
Yeah, that for students to like continually ask questions and realize that, you know, there are serious problems in the world, and that they need to not just run from them. You know, I mean, you do have to be careful, especially when they're in high school and they still have a, you know, youthful side. You don't want to just completely hit them over the head with the Anthropocene epoch necessarily, and, you know, the end of the world or anything. But at the same time, to teach them not to just take things for granted, and that, you know, living as social beings, you know, only thinking of ourselves is, and only succumbing to kind of the mainstream, very vapid, wealth obsessed culture isn't really good for the future. And, you know, I don't have any, there's students who I'm sure don't resonate with my you know, perspective on things, and every student you're not going to have that impact on, but the school, you know, does have an ethos, and it is extreme for an independent school. It is very diverse because the school puts a significant amount of resources to that, so students do see a lot of different things. And you know, I think that I want them to come away with that they need to kind of question question the status quo, but in a thoughtful way, not just to be rebellious, just to be rebellious. I also don't think is the best thing to teach high school kids. You know, like, they've got enough of that. Their youth will have their own experience of that. But
I mean, some of these kids must be also getting into, you know, EDM, and it must be kind of funny to see, like, in a way, this current of electronic dance music, which in some sense flows continuously from, you know, those moments in the 90s coming from earlier moments. But do you still see that there's some kind of transformative potential inside that zone, or does it look more like something that's just kind of lost its moment and there's other things that are more important to pay attention to? Do you still see the way that that plays a role in changing, you know, consciousness or behavior or whatever
probably not so much.
Yeah.
You know, it has been incredibly commercialized, and, you know, that being said, it might come into some thing that I'm not aware of, or, you know, I'd say by and large what I see with the kids that are interested in that. I will say they are always curious about, you know, I do work the ex-DJ or semi-retired DJ thing to get cool points with the kids. You know, there are little things to work with them, and some of the DJs I've had and whatnot are who are interested in it. They, you know, they find this interesting when they hear about these, and they kind of know about this golden age a little bit. I don't think there's a lot being offered to them to really, you know, find that. And that's probably not the space where I would look to try to cultivate it. But yeah. Again, who knows where it might go. I think the EDM thing also is musically, I think it kind of hit not that interesting of an evolution. There's still some great stuff out there, and I still enjoy it, and I still think people can put together some great stuff, but I'd say by and large it's musically isn't all that interesting. And
tell me about the work you do. I mean, on this topic with Kenji Williams. I mean, you guys have done some interesting stuff together, which is sort of like taking a thread of that electronic dance thing and trying to put it into a larger context, more kind of theatrical one that also, you know, shifts the consciousness in a certain way.
Yeah. So Kenji is a filmmaker and musician who I've known for about 20 years. And, you know, he used to play in a band called Medicine Drum and, you know, kind of did that stuff for a while. And then maybe eight years ago or so, he's working on a project, and somebody flew him out to Kazakhstan to see a Soyuz rocket launch. He was working with a Japanese space tourist, wealthy guy who was supposed to go to space, although that ended up not happening. And he was just taken, but he met all these astronauts there who were telling him their experience of seeing the Earth from space. And he just kind of thought, how could I bring that experience? They're just being like, wow, this really is an interconnected whole. That's not just like a bunch of new age blather. You know, when you're up there and you see it like this and you just orbit around it hundreds of times over however many days or months, it really is shockingly profound. And he was like, most people aren't going to be able to have that experience. So how could I bring that into sort of like a planetarium show through music and, you know, immersive video spaces, sometimes 3D domes, sometimes just high resolution video, and kind of in a sort of, I don't know, Baraka or Koyani Scotsy sort of visual collage type thing, but with where the music sort of opens up the emotional side of things. So that just, it ended up kind of, he started kind of playing with that idea. And some people from NASA saw it, and NASA produces a bunch of, they have a whole Earth science division that a lot of people don't even know exists. And they produce like scientific visualizations of their data, but it's all kind of spread out and it's not that unified. And he saw this opportunity where it's, you know, public domain stuff. So he would incorporate some of it into his show along with this, you know, kind of flying out to space and flying in. There's some software program that sort of planetarium grade Google Earth programs, and then cutting that with also like kind of zoom in and zoom out and look at a culture and then look at it from space. And so these people at NASA resonated with it and said, oh, you guys should write, we have some education grants, so you should apply for it. And he needed some help and reached out to me. And so I kind of, with a couple colleagues at NASA, sort of put together an education part so he would do the show. Like, we ended up getting a 4-year grant to do this, where he would come in and kind of do the show at their planetarium at these science centers, like 5 science centers around the country. And then off of that, we would have an earth science workshop and bring some work with some Native American communities, bring some Native teachers and intercultural dialogue at like how to look at the earth. And then also sort of promote this NASA earth science and try to show students some, you know, these are some career possibilities. And I just had found that earth science is a really interesting landscape of, you know, being a hard science, but I found the people that work in it, they really, you know, they have a very deep and profound perspective on the earth. And,
it's an interesting question too, like, because like as a, you know, you've written on media ecology and the sort of the way that media functions is like to, I mean, how effective do you think sort of performance, theater, immersive electronic environments, that kind of logic of media as experience, does it work? What does it need? Does it help when you have these like teach-ins around it? Does that actually help it kind of become more than a spectacle? Because now you can go online and you look at space shuttle footage and you're like, whatever, and you put some electronic music to it, and it's just another sort of form of visual stimulation that doesn't necessarily produce the overview effect that astronauts talk about. In fact, it might even sort of cheapen it, because we're like, oh, yes, yeah, I've seen that. Right. Da, da, da. So how does that work? What's the kind of optimum balance of information and experience, or what kind of hopes do you have for that approach to changing consciousness, at least in the ecological situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really still been in a pilot stage, and I definitely don't want to oversight. There's not one thing that you're going to come in and sit down and transform people's consciousness, but I do think the effort that we made to build other parts of it a lot of the times this, you know, students love just doing kind of like a basic little science experiment, not quite a little difficult, you know, like a vinegar and baking soda volcano, and they enjoyed that as much as seeing the show. Others, that was what really did it for them. Last year when we worked with the Native American Chemawa boarding school, we had a whole element of singing and of traditional singing and an elder teaching. And so, you know, I think we need to experiment with these things. The media thing is to be careful about sort of utopian dreams of sitting in a room or putting in, all of a sudden you're just gonna, it's all, you're gonna have this technosis experience, so to speak. But I also think it's so much part of things. And with some deeper thought, you know, as an adjunct to paying attention to human connection. And I also think something as powerful of doing the work of producing a show, which can have a spectacle side to it. It's also about the work that you do with other people and giving a new platform for, say, like an earth scientist to work with an artist, which is they would never really do, you know? And then you find these earth scientists who are also, you know, plays bass in a band and I think it's like, we need to put attention to, you know, that part of it is it's not just the final product, but it's also about the processes and relationships that we build. I would say all this work I feel is still at an early stage and need to be careful about, you know, not overhyping it, but, you know, there is no two ways about it. This technology is here to stay. And, you know, I'd like just to see people try to experiment and do something with it than just ignoring it. I don't think that's a viable approach either. And we're open to revision, you know?
Absolutely. We were talking, we have about 10 minutes left, and when we were chatting before about the work you're doing and your teaching environment, you were talking about how there are growing numbers of Chinese students in your school, something that private schools are seeing, you know, across the country. People are coming over here to get American education and to move into the American university system, and that this has kind of also changed your perspective, gotten you thinking more about China and some of the possibilities of China, including the sort of eco-civilization projects that are kind of growing over there. So I just love to hear a little bit more about that, like when you sort of really kind of grokked that there was going to be more Chinese students coming into your courses and that you wanted to get up to snuff with their world or how they were coming in, what they were coming in with. What was that journey like for you?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm thinking back to about 5-6 years ago when it first started, and just being faced with the language barrier. And I remember I had a student just really was struggling and I didn't quite know what to do. And yet he managed to come through, and I saw him over the summer, and he's at University of Arizona and is like, you know, really happy and really valued the experience he had. So, I definitely find there's a humility about it too, because I see the kids sometimes struggling with language, and I feel like, well, I don't speak Chinese. I wish I could do more for them. But also just learning to sit with that and then just be more open to kind of, you know, having the conversation where it can be at, helping them, meeting them where they are. And I've seen a lot of these kids just make incredible strides and impressed just with their, the challenges they face and how they work through it. And just to see a young mind learning, can go in a couple of months from barely able to communicate to actually writing you a few paragraphs that are not bad, you know, and we're reading, you know, fairly complex stuff. But also strange too, to see it's so caught up in international capitalism and this strange shift in China from, you know, it's still communist, Marxist, but not, and its whole place in the world. These students being able to come over is a big indicator of just that rise in the middle and upper middle class in China, because these are students that have the means, I see them get sucked up a little bit into the consumerist culture. And then there's also students, you know, who are incredibly thoughtful and bring just like a very unique perspective to things. And, I got to sort of being more aware of that. I have recently come across some scholars in a program out at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California. And so now I've gotten to talk to like doctoral students and professors who are really, they're over here for fellowships. And it's interesting, you know, their English might not necessarily be that much better than my students, but they're obviously, you know, they're much older and are scholars in a variety of different fields, and just fascinating to hear what they're thinking about and just the profound challenges that China is facing. And yet also, thousands of years, 3,000-4,000 of years of civilization, where it seems like there's a lot to draw on, but they're not quite sure how to do it. And the scale, that's, I think, the thing that blows most people away, is the scale of China is just overwhelming.
Yeah, just when you think about, like, the new cities, you know, the size of these cities that over the last, you know, 5-10 years have, like, a whole new city and the blink of an eye, there it is. And you're like, and so as they're doing that, of course they're thinking about, well, what makes a good city? What's an eco? How do we make our cities more ecologically sensitive? How do we actually deal with it? I mean, at the same time in which they face terrible pollution and, you know, very, very difficult environmental problems, there is still also some very interesting projects in China that are aware of it. It's almost because the scale is so crazy that you could almost try something new and something might really work. But what is the eco-civilization stuff that you've been looking at?
Well, there was a conference called Seizing an Alternative Toward an Ecological Civilization, organized by this 91-year-old professor named John Cobb, who's one of the descendants of Alfred North Whitehead, and has brought somehow figured out how process philosophy and theology could make a contribution into what he and his colleagues call constructive postmodernism. Is this philosophy of the organism that is useful in trying to think about developing an eco-civilization. And I really appreciate it. He's just really, you can tell cares about the world even at this late date in his life, and somehow recognized, years ago that China is really important in all of this and started creating centers for process theology and philosophy at like 20 different universities in China, and him and his colleagues were thinking about new ways of reformulating Marxism. A professor named Philip Clayton has a book out called Organic Marxism. This is just starting to read a very interesting take on trying to rethink Marxism in an ecological sense, and that could be applied to China. And
that's really important stuff, because that's one of the great stumbling blocks of Marxism, as people try to wrestle with the need for new political economies and for a new kind of materialism, is that with all the tools that classical Marxism has that are still really spot on for a lot of the economic and geopolitical issues that are going on today, there's this like real gap there, at least in the way that Marxism has been articulated, because of the split between a sort of scientific materialism and a historical materialism early on. And people seem to be that seems to be changing, though. There's aspects in Marxist history that are being rediscovered and reworked in order to have a more systems-driven view, taking more from organicism as opposed to the kind of classic Marxist move of like, oh, if you're going to talk about holism or organ or organic or nature, anything like that, that's just total ideology. You're full of it. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And obviously that needs to change if that approach is going to update itself for the Anthropocene.
Yeah. And I think the other part that isn't spoken real loud, but is also that some kind of role for spirituality, and that gets real touchy, and I trying to figure out that with the few Chinese scholars that I've been talking with recently, it's quite complex. But I think there's there are strains in looking to certain aspects of Chinese tradition, wherever it may be, whether it's Confucianism or Taoism or the good parts of the Marxist piece, which that had pretty much flushed out any kind of talk of spirituality. I think it's finding this in a postmodern way that can be digestible and not overly dogmatic, but still realize that people do have these other drives and needs and whatever words you put to them, and that however it works, there does need to be some rapprochement or détente between some of these really hard challenges and wherever some piece of useful insight might be found, I think it's is needed, and of course has to be reformulated in a way that's realistic for today. But the research I've been doing is that the Chinese government, actually in their latest sort of party congresses in the last few years, have actually stated that they need to create an ecological civilization. Now I know that's in tension with their all the economic development, and it may just be words at this moment, but even in the government there is a sense that over the longer term there's no escape from them trying to deal with this, and the level of potential cataclysm in their country is just, again, at a scale that's hard to get one's mind around, but it's hopeful, I think a little bit of that sense of it may be all going downhill, but let's see what we can do to
yeah, absolutely, get man. Out of it, and so
blow up.
Yeah, so we have to wrap it up there, Ronan. You know, thanks so much for sharing your life and your current obsessions and fascinations.
Great, thanks for asking.
All right, man. Ronan Halliwell, high school teacher, New Roads, Santa Monica, Big Think. All right, from till next week, keep your minds open.